All right, so we're going to talk about dinosaurs and how they fit into the Bible. Because this is a really common question. When you're introduced to concepts like Dr. Morse has presented, you know, that the fossil record is best interpreted by way of the global flood, often people, you know, are, okay, I can kind of accept that, but then how do the dinosaurs fit in? You know, it's a really common question. Last spring, I taught a class on astronomy, and at the end of that talk, someone came up and asked me, what about the dinosaurs? It's a very, very, very common question. And if you have never heard the creationist perspective on dinosaurs, you're likely to find this a little bit shocking, because we've been so indoctrinated with a naturalist perspective of history that the true history of the world has been lost. It's not just been written or revised, it's been erased. And everything you know about dinosaurs, everything that you've been taught from secular media, Discovery Channel, these kind of things, largely is wrong. And so you're likely to find this a little bit on the challenging side, and some of you may find yourself skeptical, but in my opinion, what I'm going to show you is the most accurate description of the true history of dinosaurs that we can derive at this point, using the Bible as our basis for what truth is. Because there's an ultimate truth. You can debate about your views, but there is a truth out there. And that's ultimately what we're trying to get at. And it is, you can't get there without the Bible, really, as your starting document. Because, we've already talked a lot about worldviews and a lot about the fossil record, but I want to hit this one more time just to drive something home. Because ultimately, when you're talking about dinosaurs, you're talking about paleontology, geology level stuff. And remember that any given geological formation can be interpreted one of two ways. Something like this, Monument Valley, Utah, can be interpreted in two different ways. The rock that's out here is sandstone. It's a rock that has been reworked, meaning it had dissolved away into, eroded away into particles, and then was just moved and then redeposited, forming what was originally a layer of sandstone all the way up to the top of those monuments. Something deposited all of that sandstone there, and then something eroded away all the sandstone that's missing. You can interpret that one of two ways. Either it was deposited rapidly and eroded rapidly, potentially during the global flood of Noah, or it was deposited slowly and gradually at current rates over hundreds of millions of years and then eroded away once the climate changed from a depositional environment to erosional environment. Eventually, it weathered it all away. Where it all went, bit of hard to explain, well, unless you're talking about a catastrophic sweep away, right? But one of the things we got to keep in mind is that the scientific community is trying to interpret our world through philosophical naturalism, okay? That only natural processes have been in effect. But it is impossible to incorrectly interpret a world with a supernatural history through rigid philosophical naturalism, and that's exactly what they're trying to do. Geologists are not stupid, and they are not blind. The evidence for the global flood is glaring us right in the face, but they are simply trying to interpret that rock evidence through a different philosophical perspective. And it's impossible to correctly interpret the fossil record through philosophical naturalism if it was ultimately due to an act of supernatural intervention. Okay? And this is an important point. I want to drive this home a little bit, because a lot of people can't understand why it is that that's impossible. Why is it impossible to interpret this if it formed through geological processes? You should be able to draw that interpretation regardless of how, what happened, that, you know, if so there was a global flood, should be able to interpret that, right? It's impossible to interpret those rock layers as being due to a global flood. Now, remember, there's two different interpretations. Either these layers form slowly and gradually over hundreds of millions of years, or they form catastrophically during massive movement, okay? But the layers of rocks that cover the earth are hundreds of feet thick, kilometers thick in places. We're talking about lots and lots of layers of rocks. Layers of rocks that nothing could have survived if it was formed during a massive global flood. That's the key point. A geologist, through a naturalist perspective, must believe that the life that exists today on top of those layers of rocks survived the formation of those layers on their own. They must believe that. And the only way that could happen is if those layers form slowly and gradually over hundreds of millions of years. Do you understand that? That is a very simple concept, but very, very key to understanding why geologists cannot interpret the fossil record through philosophical naturalism. Nothing could have survived the formation of those layers. It would have been impossible. And the Bible says it was impossible. The only reason why life exists is because of an act of supernatural intervention. God told Noah there was going to be a flood, told him how to prepare a vessel that could survive the flood, brought all those animals to him and put them on the ark, and they're here today through an act of supernatural intervention. It precludes or prevents the correct interpretation of geological evidence. Do you understand? Important point. Important point. All right, so with regard to the dinosaurs, though, we got to interpret those as well into a different worldview, into this correct worldview, the worldview that there was a, you know, God created the world and there was this event, this global flood event that reshaped the entire planet. And the fact that dinosaurs are an overwhelming part of the fossil record means one thing for sure. They were, if the fossil record is the result of the global flood, the animals that are in the fossil record were alive at the time of the global flood, killed by that event, buried and petrified. The fact that the dinosaurs are an overwhelming part of the fossil record, and because the Bible says that two of every sort was put on board the ark, we can only then conclude that the dinosaurs must have been also. Okay, the dinosaurs must also have been put on board the ark, like all the other animals, and survived the global flood and were reintroduced afterwards. We can only conclude that people have always known about dinosaurs. Today we're told that dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, tens of millions of years before humans ever walked the planet. It's a big distinction, okay? And so, but If the biblical perspective is true, I don't think there's any other conclusion we can draw. That dinosaurs were alive at the time of the flood, they were on board the ark, they were reintroduced afterwards, and by and large, people probably have always known about these creatures. They may not have seen them all the time and probably kept their distance from them, you know, like I would have, but nonetheless, you know what I mean? That's a perspective I think that we must reach if we're using the Bible as our background basis, okay? So let's talk a little bit about dinosaurs and what they are. Nothing in this picture is a dinosaur, okay? Which I want to just clear up a few things, okay? These are all, or these two are reptiles. The plesiosaur and the pterosaur are themselves reptiles, but they're not dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are a particular super order of reptiles. This is a Dimetrodon. It was once considered, I believe it was once in dinosaur, a sub taxa of dinosaur, but then they elevated it because they consider it an evolutionary important organism, and now it's what they call the mammal-like reptiles. It has slightly different structures they consider it. Nonetheless, and that one, of course, that's a mammal. That's not a reptile at all. Okay, but there are two main groups of dinosaurs, and they're basically distinguished by the type of bone structure that they have there. And I'm not really concerned about that you know all of this anatomy, but I want to help you with your terminology a little bit. S-A-U-R means lizard, okay? Ornith, O-R-N-I-T-H, means bird. And the rest of this word is referring to a particular bone in the pelvis. These are the lizard-hipped dinosaurs and the bird-hipped dinosaurs, okay? And all the dinosaurs fit into one of those two groups, lizard-hipped and bird-hipped. So let's review these a little bit. The main groups of dinosaurs in these two main sections, okay? On one, you got the big theropods. Pod or poda, when you see that in a scientific word, that means foot. Thera means beast-footed. These are the big beast-footed dinosaurs, the ones that had the great big three-toed feet, clawed feet, enormous feet. This is similar to the T-Rex, Allosaurus all belong to this group. This is actually the Gigantosaurus, slightly bigger than a T-Rex, about 50 foot in length, skull 6 foot in length. Could pick you up and pretty much swallow you whole. But they weren't the biggest. There are a lot of big theropods. The biggest was actually this Spinosaurus right here. If you've seen, Dawn of the Dinosaurs? Anyone seen Ice Age? Am I the only one that watches cartoons around here? I don't know. Maybe I am. Yeah, okay. Got some people that say. Well, there was a T-Rex in there, right? And the T-Rex is chasing him for a while. And then eventually something else starts chasing the T-Rex. And that was Spinosaurus. Its name was similar. Too, spiny or something. I don't remember what they call it, but its name was similar. of the big theropods, the Tyrannosaurus in particular, is distributed mostly in most of dinosaur fossils, period, have been found in North America. Most of them. And along a distribution pattern that follows a particular latitude. This is typical distribution pattern for dinosaurs right here. This is just the Tyrannosaurus, the family of dinosaurs to which the Tyrannosaurus belongs. But every once in a while, they'll find one scattered down up under here, but most of them seem to be distributed along a similar pattern there. Okay? Also in the Saurischians, again, the lizard-hipped dinosaurs, are the sauropods. Okay? Lizard-footed. Okay? So these, you can see their foot's big different. They got the five toes instead of the big three-toed claws. Bit different. You got this is the largest group of dinosaurs belong here and the largest animal that's ever lived. Once they thought the blue whale was the biggest, but now the big the Diplodocus, the Supersaurus is the bigger one, is the biggest one, 115 foot in length total. Wouldn't you have just loved to have seen one of those things, you know? At least from a distance? Maybe from a helicopter? Yeah, helicopter. All right, there we go. Everyone's in agreement on that one. Maybe me too a little bit. Could be a little scary. Okay, so Saurischians, those basically those two main groups. Within the Ornithischians, Ornithischian again means bird-hipped dinosaurs. And within this, you got bird-footed dinosaurs, ornithopods. But there are several groups that belong in here, like the Ankylosaur has a crown of structure on its head. It's got the big plates on its back, or what they call scutes, and some of them had a great big club on the end of its tail. Not overly large in comparison to the other dinosaurs. Stegosaurus, most people can recognize a Stegosaurus, right? Had these huge plates on its back and a series of spikes on its tail. Pretty big, though. Pretty big. This thing definitely would have been scary. Most of these in this group, you know, many of the dinosaurs were herbivores, but yeah, I don't think that would have mattered much. I think we'd still be running from that thing. Well, I would have been running, and they probably would have charged you. If you notice, I didn't give you a pointed out, and the Ankylosaur had a bird's beak. The Ceratops also had basically a bird's beak. Many of these did. Ceratops was an enormous creature also, like the Triceratops. So there's the Utriceratops and Triceratops, pretty big, 30 feet in length maximum. And most of these could run like 35 miles an hour. You know, the fastest human can run about that speed, but that's about it. Similar distribution pattern. Most of them have been found in North America, with a few minors found elsewhere. And every once in a while, you'll find one down in South America or Africa or even in Australia. But they're rare. The Hadrosaur. Bird bill. Again, this is one of the bird-footed dinosaurs. And in addition to bird-hipped, bird-footed dinosaurs. Once thought to have lived in this kind of environment, but later examinations of stomach contents, they found ferns and things that later caused them to conclude that they were actually mountainous creatures. Looks nice and friendly, right? This thing's big, though. Look at the size of the Hadrosaur in comparison to even Spinosaur, Stegosaur, Ceratops. Thing was big, 50 foot in length. Whether it was a plant eater or not, probably would have been running from that one. Now, one of the big questions that concerns us, even still today, is what happened to the dinosaurs? So they once existed. They were once, you know, the mightiest of God's creation, and they're no longer here today. And the theories abound. The problem with these theories is that there are a great many animals still alive today that were alive at the time of the dinosaurs. And they're exactly the same as they were at the time of the dinosaurs. Many cold-blooded animals. By dinosaurs are largely believed to be cold-blooded, but there's some debate on that. Scientists largely assume that they died due to climatic changes, due to either large asteroid bombardment or potentially volcanism. But the asteroid impact theory is probably predominant. That's a large asteroid came down, struck the Earth, caused a climactic shift in the Earth, and the dinosaurs were unable to survive that. But again, the problem with that is that there are great many animals alive today that were alive at the time of the dinosaurs. And still doing just fine. It's a problem. Others believe that actually the dinosaurs didn't go extinct, but or at least some of them have evolved into birds. Right? That's a generally held belief that dinosaurs have evolved into birds. How that actually took place is to some degree a mystery. You can propose your own theory. You know, there's a variety of ways that they, you know, I don't know, this one, you know, one scientist theory on how they might have evolved into birds. I don't know. But one One issue with regarding to the origin or the evolution of flight is that flight, generally speaking, broadly amongst all the animals that can fly, appears suddenly in the fossil record. We didn't check this. Hopefully my sound is still good.
Evolution teaches that flying animals evolved from land animals, but new discoveries here in Germany are causing problems for this theory.
There's a 10 million year period of early mammal evolution where you would guess that there'd be some sort of a bat precursor, but once again, nothing. Bingo, they just show up. Here's a very highly complex mammal with all these adaptations, and bingo, they just show up at some particular moment in time, fully formed as a bat. Obviously, we evolutionary biologists and paleontologists don't believe that, but at this point, we don't have a good fossil ancestor for them.
This same problem occurs not only for bats, but also for flying reptiles.
When the pterosaurs first appear in the geological record, they were completely, they were perfect. They were perfect pterosaurs.
Still a big mystery, but I tend to hold the view that the dinosaurs, at least the ones in the fossil record, were rather killed during the global flood. I think we can pretty much rely upon that particular conclusion. And you can point to a lot of evidence of this. Dinosaurs that, Dr. Moore showed you pictures of dinosaurs, pterosaurs that were in the death pose, right? Did you see? Very compelling. Find a lot of them that are preserved completely intact with skin and all. And, you know, you could have even found some with soft, stretchy tissue. This T-Rex bone was found in 2005. And in the process of transporting it, they dropped it and broke it open, and in the inside they found tissue that was soft and stretchy and would snap back, and even potentially blood vessels with hemoglobin inside. Such tissues would only be preserved if that animal was buried instantly after death, or potentially death was caused by the burial, because decomposition takes over fairly rapidly. So these examples point definitively to a rapid burial event. But there are a lot of questions with regard to whether or not dinosaurs truly were alive at the time of the flood, and whether they would have been on board the ark. Could they have been on board the ark? Those are some big, big animals. You know what I mean? Is it feasible? Is it logistically possible for someone to load all those animals on board the ark? So a few things for you to consider. All right. The ark itself was enormous, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Big, big, big ship. Okay, 450 feet long, size of 1.5 football fields, 3 stories high, 75 feet wide. Absolutely enormous. Then, one thing I want you to consider is how many dinosaurs would you need? You could argue the fact that there may have been as few as 4 kinds of dinosaurs. Arguable point that some of these, there may have been more, but many of these types, like the ceratops, you know, there are a lot of ceratops species, but I don't think there's any more diversity there than you're going to find amongst the dog breeds or any of the animals that we know are all related. You know, it's a lot of diversity, but arguably there was only 1 pair of ceratops on board the ark, 1 pair of hadrosaurs on board the ark. You don't need a lot of them. Just remember, there was 1 pair of every animal, 7 of every clean animal. So the clean animals are the obligate herbivores, with the cloven hooves and right cutting stuff. So these would have been considered unclean. It wouldn't have been on board the ark. But what about their size? Even 1 pair of something like this might have, you know, been problematic. Could that have fit in one, you know, could that even have fit? How tall were these stories anyway? That's a big dinosaur. But consider the size of these creatures. These are the different sizes of Tyrannosaur species. You only need 1 pair of Tyrannosaurs to put on board the ark. You're not going to go grabbing Tyrannosaurus or the gigantus, or excuse me, Tyrannosaurus, the biggest of the Tyrannosaur dinosaurs, and put that on board the ark. You're going to choose one that's a little more manageable. But and God brought these to the ark, remember? Specifically says that God sent to the ark. And he would have sent one with nice, good genetic diversity, ready to repopulate the earth with its particular kind. Ceratops the same. Look at the size distribution of the ceratops. The average size is no bigger than a common bull. No problem at all there. Then consider the growth pattern of these creatures. Yeah. Most organisms have an S-shaped growth curve. You know, this would be the time when your junior hires shoot up, right? Costing you all them shoes and stuff. If you just keep them in socks for a couple years, I'm wondering, you know. But you wouldn't put a great big tyrannosaur. It's, you know, the big dinosaurs that we find in the fossil record. I mean, these things could have been, you know, were probably just really, really old. Remember, the flood occurred 1,500 years, or about close to 1450, but about 1,500 years after the creation. And humans at that point lived to be 900 years old or so, right? Reptiles grow as long as they live. And some of them live older than we do still. So, I mean, it's possible that some of these things were 1,000 years old, some of these big dinosaurs. Some of them could have potentially been original creations that were just still alive and enormous. It's probable that the dinosaurs never again reached those sizes, even after the flood. But you would have taken a nice, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old there and put that on board the ark. Much more manageable. Even the ones that would have got enormous, you wouldn't have had any problem there. Dinosaurs definitely could have fit on board the ark. I see no problem with that. Okay? Assuming this is true, dinosaurs are on board the ark and reintroduced after the flood, is there any evidence that dinosaurs were indeed known to humans, that they lived after the flood? Is there any archaeological evidence for the existence of dinosaurs? One of the things we got to keep in mind when we look at past historical record or search these records for evidence of dinosaurs that were known to humans, we got to keep in mind that the word dinosaur is a very recent invention. Dinosaurs really discovered early in the 1800s. One of the first discovered was the iguanodon in 1822. The iguanodon was... I'm checking my pocket, make sure it's nothing. Fortunately, it's someone else. All right. Well, the word dinosaur was coined, I think it was actually coined in 1842, but it was coined around this time. The word dinosaur was originally coined to describe these large reptilian animals that they had recently discovered in the fossil record, okay? Before this word was coined, they were typically known of as dragons or serpents. Today, the word serpent has changed so that it's synonymous with snakes, but in old English diction, snakes and serpents were different, distinct from one another. A snake was a legless serpent. Serpents were animals with long necks and long tails, okay? And you can find many descriptions where a serpent is described by how many legs it has, okay? Meet the Draco Rex, or its full name is Draco Rex Hogwartus or something like that, from like Harry Potter or something. It's close to that. It may not be exactly right, but it's the Draco Rex. We know that there were dinosaurs that had, you know, remarkable similarities to the animals that later became described or are known to us as dragons. And to say that dragons were important in ancient times would be an understatement. I mean, they were significant to the peoples of ancient times. You can find them on calendars like the Chinese zodiac. The Chinese zodiac has everyday animals on it. Every animal that's on the Chinese zodiac is known to us as an everyday common animal. And the dragon, which was itself an everyday common animal to the Chinese people in ancient times. England, Scotland, Wales, there's a dragon on the flag of Wales, Scandinavia, Germany, France. In these countries, there is a significant, lengthy, rich history of descriptions and depictions of dragons. They knew them by different names, but they usually knew of them, they usually knew of multiple types or had multiple names for different types of dragons. You can find them in city seals in addition to flags. There are cities that are named after dragons or the person who killed a dragon. There are people have been venerated or made saints for killing dragons. Every natural history book and encyclopedia science book that was published before the 1800s had descriptions and depictions of dragons, and usually multiple types. They would describe particular incidents. This one describes an incident where a shepherd saw a dragon in Switzerland. And, you know, before you dismiss this image as like, what? You know what I mean? That looks ridiculous. Let's look at this for most important characteristics. It's three-toed feet. It's got three toes, long neck, long tail, and a crown-like structure on the top of its head. Okay, and look at this one. Those are the basic characteristics of your theropods, your beast-footed creatures. Three-toed, these big three-toed feet and hands. and its crown-like structure, its long neck and its long tail. And before you criticize that person who made that last description, just consider for yourself how much better of a description would you have been able to give? How long would you have stood there and taken a mental picture of that thing? Oh, that's a, look at, and he's got a little bit of glistening and stuff, and I like the little thing he's got there. No, we'd have been running, you know? Now look at the picture again, and just consider, you know, I'm not saying that's exactly the animal that was seen there, but there you can definitely find parallels for all the depictions of these dragons that you find in these kinds of early scientific descriptions of dragons. There are dragons mentioned in the Bible. The Hebrew word tanyan was translated dragon in the King James Version. Later versions ended up translating it as monster, but the dragon appears on several occasions in the Bible. In Isaiah, in that day, the Lord with his sore and great strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Leviathan is specifically described in the book of Job. The only book in the Bible that's believed to be older than Job is Genesis itself. It's an ancient text that, and the descriptions of the animals that are in Job were made by God. God was describing his creation, describes a number of animals that we know of, and then describes two that sound very much like they must be dinosaurs. One of them is called Leviathan. A brief portion of the description, you can go and read the rest of it yourself. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Around his teeth there is terror. His strong scales are his pride, shut up as with a tight seal. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, glowing also. Out of his mouth go burning torches. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw. Bronze is rotten wood. The arrows cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him. Some commentators will claim that this just was an alligator or something, but alligators can easily be pierced with a spear or those kind of things. You're talking about something much more formidable here than an alligator. There's another that's called the behemoth. Look at behemoth, which I made along with you, and which feeds on grass like an ox, an herbivore. What strength he has in his loins, what power in the muscles of his belly. His tail sways like a cedar, the sinews of his thighs are close-knit. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are rods of iron. Some of the Bible commentaries will say that this was either a hippopotamus or an elephant. It is described as the chief amongst God's creations, as if it was the largest creature that God had made. And the elephant and the hippopotamus were certainly not that. The blue whale is definitely the largest. And we only now know that the Gigantosaurus, or the Supersaurus, is indeed bigger than the blue whale. But the tail being like a cedar is a definite, you know, problem for interpretations or commentators that would suggest it was an elephant or a hippopotamus, because neither the elephant nor the hippopotamus have a tail that's anything like a cedar, right? They got a little bitty spindly tail, right? But this is definitely much more consistent with one of your big sauropods, okay? Definitely consistent. If you look through the history, you can find a number of ancient descriptions and depictions of dragons. And I can only give you a brief coverage of this, but I'll point out a few of them to you. Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote of seeing creatures that sound like pterosaurs, like your big pterodactyls. There is a place in Arabia situated very near the city of Buto, to which I went on hearing of some winged serpents. And when I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe. The form of the serpent is like that of a water snake, but he has wings without feathers, and as like as possible to the wings of a bat. Some will claim that these descriptions were just of fossils that people had seen. But I don't know if you've seen, you can't tell what the creature looked like from fossils, much less that what its wings texture was like, that it actually had membranous wings rather than feathers. And the quantities that it's describing are certainly those of creatures that were being killed at the time. There is a dragon described in an apocryphal book of Daniel, a story known as Bel and the Dragon. There's a Daniel challenges the worship of a god that the Babylonians were worshiped by the name of Bel, and then subsequently dispatches a dragon that they were worshiping. And it's an apocryphal book. It's found in the Greek Septuagint and the Latin Vulgate. It's retained within the Catholic Bible, but in the Protestant Bible, it's not part of our canon. But nonetheless, the description works reads like this: "And in that same place there was a great dragon, which they of Babylon worshipped. And the king said unto Daniel, Wilt thou also say that this is of brass? Because the bell was an idol that they were worshipping. Lo, he liveth, he eateth and drinketh. Thou cannot say that he is no living God, therefore worship him. Then said Daniel unto the king, I will worship the Lord my God, for he is the living God. But give me leave, O king, and I shall slay this dragon without sword or staff. The king said, I give thee leave. Then Daniel took pitch and fat and hair, and did seeth them together, and made lumps thereof. This he put in the dragon's mouth, and so the dragon burst in sunder. And Daniel said, Lo, these are the gods ye worship." Like I say, it's not part of the Protestant canon, but there is a dragon on the Ishtar Gate in Babylon that would seem to add credibility to the fact that the Babylonians not only knew of dragons, but revered them as well. Only the dragon and a bull, which is well was probably the single most important animal to the Babylonians, are on the Ishtar Gate. There are lions along the procession way, but it's just the dragon and the bull seen there. Alexander the Great reported seeing dragons in India that the people of India were worshiping in 330 BC. It is said that one of his generals also brought back a dragon. There's a picture on the Nile mosaic dating to 100 BC that looks fairly definitively like a dinosaur. It's got what obviously looks like a bird's beak, and it's a quadruped with a long tail. The only animals we know of like that are these ornithischian dinosaurs, the great many of which had bird's beaks. And so it looks very much like a dinosaur that is being hunted there on the side of the Nile. The story of Beowulf is this is a very famous and considered one of the most important Saxon works of literature that we have, is a story of an epic work known by the name Beowulf, which tells the story of the person named Beowulf who killed several dragons. Dating somewhere around the 6th century AD, Beowulf was called by the king of a nearby region to kill a dragon that was attacking his great hall. So his dad, Beowulf's father, was already in service to the king to pay off a debt, and so Beowulf was pretty much obligated to come in at his bidding. But when he arrives, he first kills a number of sea dragons that were causing havoc for the shipping lanes, pulled their bodies up and laid them out on the beach for inspection, then took on the dragon that was attacking their great hall, one they called a Grendel. And killed this Grendel, which was described to be that like that of a man. Most believe that means he was standing upright or bipedal instead of a quadruped. And it said that he killed it by ripping off one of its arms, which they then later mounted on the wall of the Great Hall. And many assume this means one of these theropods that had these little bitty arms. Beowulf ultimately lost his life by then afterwards fighting or trying to kill a winged dragon, which ultimately caused him to receive a mortal wound. And a lot of people believe that these stories are fictitious, but the author of these stories, if it is a work of fiction, wove into them an amazing amount of historical accuracy, because archaeological evidence and historical evidence has subsequently revealed that the great majority of the people that are described in the epic of Beowulf were actual people. Their relationships to one another, the places and times in which they live, are valid. And so if it was a work of fiction, there's an amazing amount of history that the author has used to create a fictitious work. It would be unprecedented. A number of these grave mounds have been verified archaeologically that belong to the people that are described in the Beowulf epic, including Beowulf's, which was discovered in 1950. Beowulf's grave mound. They also found great halls that date at the time that the Beowulf epic says they were, and the place. They've also found the great halls. It would be odd that only the dragon portion of the story would be fictitious. On the walls of a cathedral in Breedon-on-the-Hill, Leicestershire, England, there is a carving that looks to be that of a large bipedal dinosaur attacking a group of quadrupeds. There's one biting this one, and another one here, large back legs, is definitely walking up on its back legs and has what looks like small arms. And it has been asserted that, and this is a Saxon carving that dates some between the 8th and 10th century, and has been suggested at least that this creature that you see in this carving may have been that was described in the Beowulf epic as the Grendel. Legend has it that the word gargoyle, the word that we use to describe the dragon-like sculptures that are used as water spouts on cathedrals and churches, dates back to a dragon that was attacking a town in France. The dragon was ultimately hunted by the bishop of the area, who was later venerated to status of a saint. It's said that the bishop went out with a convict and wrapped its shawl around the creature and guided it back into town, where the townspeople then killed it, burned it, mounted its head up on the side of the church to show God's power, and then later it was replaced with a sculpture. Interesting, though. You can find a number of these descriptions of where people had killed dragons. There's Krakow, Poland, is one of the oldest cities in Poland, and is today the second largest. Krakow, the city, was named after the person Krakus, who was once a king there, that had killed a dragon. The sculpture you see here on the bank of the actually breathes fire periodically, or when you send a text message, you can send a text message and it'll breathe fire for you. The dragon is said to have lived in a cave underneath Wawel Hill, so it's called the Wawel Dragon or the Dragon of Krakow. But the cave is still a popular tourist attraction, and there are bones hanging on outside of the cathedral on Wawel Hill that were said to have been found in the dragon's cave. There's a plaque right outside the cathedral. Krakus, a Polish prince, ruled from A.D. 730 to 750. Here's the cave in which, having killed the wild dragon, he settled at Wawel and founded the city of Krakow. They killed it by bait poisoning. There is a carving on the Angkor Wat, on one of the temples at Angkor Wat in Cambodia, that dates to the 12th century, that looks unmistakably like that of a what? Stegosaurus. Everyone can recognize this as Stegosaurus. Critics will either argue this in one of two ways. Again, stating that either the people have found a fossil and then carved this based on the finding of a fossil, or others have said that it's actually just standing in front of vegetation. At least for the former, one problem with that theory is that the plates on the back of the stegosaur are not attached to its skeletal system. They are embedded into its dermis or its skin, and they would have become disarticulated upon death and would not have been found associated with this, you know, so that they would have known that they were on its back like this. So that's definitely a problem. Marco Polo described seeing dragons in China. Here's just one of the descriptions. Here are found snakes and huge serpents. See, serpents are different from snakes. 10 paces in length and 10 spans in girth, which equals to 50 feet and 100 inches in circumference. At the forepart, near the head, they have two short legs, each with three claws, as well as eyes larger than a loaf and very glaring. The jaws are wide enough to swallow a man. The teeth are large and sharp, and their whole appearance is so formidable that neither man nor any kind of animal can approach them without terror. Others are smaller size, being 8, 6, 5, or paces long. Three fingers, three toes. Small hands. I mean, that's a theropod. There's really no other animal that we know of that fits that description other than one of those big bipedal theropods, the beast-footed, right, with the three fingers, three toes. They found carvings of dinosaurs on stones in Ica, Peru. Missionaries originally found them in the 16th century. Since then, a number of others have surfaced, and I think some of them may be questionable, but the original ones that were discovered seem to at least be authentic. Dinosaurs were known by a number of common names. Some of these are even found in the Bible. The Catholic Bible uses the word basilisk, a word that was used to describe dragons back in the time that the King James Version was first written. Basilisk, so was the name basilisk basically means king. This was the king serpent. This one was in a natural history work back in the 1500s. basilisk, called the named king, the king of serpents, because it had a crown-like structure on its head, a bird's-like beak, and notice the scales or the scutes on its back. When I saw this, to me it reminded me of the ankylosaur with its crown, its scutes. Not all the ankylosaurs had the big club on their tail either. Very close. There are others in the Bible called fiery flying serpents. The viper and the fiery flying serpent described in Isaiah. Some commentators will say that these were venomous serpents, but others believe that they were pterosaurs. They were actually pterosaurs. That the pterosaurs themselves either could breathe fire, as is commonly associated with dragons, or that what they were describing was simply bioluminescence. Some animals glow, produce proteins that actually cause them to glow. And the fact that some are described to have glowing eyes seems to strongly suggest that that may have been the case, at least for some of these descriptions. There's another that's called a cockatrice. Rejoice, not thou whole Palestinian, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken, for out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. So the cockatrice, the name cockatrice actually comes from the word cock, which is a male chicken, right? The cockatrice, as it showed in natural history works, had the characteristics of a rooster and of a serpent. Okay? A rooster and a serpent, thought to have actually come from a cock's egg, legend has it. And at some point, the basilisk and the cockatrice, the distinction between them became kind of blurred. But at least originally, the cockatrice was distinct in that it had wings, and the basilisk seemed to be a quadruped in most depictions. But when people knew a name of one of them, I think they would just call any old dragon that they saw one or the other. Every big serpent that they saw would end up being a basilisk. But here's one. Here's another. Chicken-like, it had the characteristics of a chicken and a long reptilian tail. And if you don't think anything like this existed, look at this one. Ornith means what? Ansar? Lizard. This mimic, the bird mimic lizard or dinosaur. And they're also known as like ostrich dinosaurs. Very close. You can find a number of descriptions of dragons. This booklet was published in 1614, and these don't come across as fictitious or fictitious works. They're frank descriptions. Describing its size and shape, it is reputed to be 9 feet or rather more in length and shaped almost in the form of an axle. An axle has, you know what an axle under a car looks like? Round in the middle, same thing. Round in the middle and two long things coming out the end. So it's shaped like the axle tree of a cart. A quantity of thickness in the middle and somewhat smaller on both ends. Think about what a sauropod looks like. Big, bulky body, long neck and long tail. You would kind of describe it like that. The former part, it shoots forth as a neck. It's supposed to be 3 foot 9 inches long, so a little bitty thing, at least at that point, with a white ring, as it were, of scales about it. The scales along its back were black, and under its belly, it was red. I mean, these are just descriptions. It's in no way comes across when you read these as being anything that was mythological. Another booklet was published in 1669, which describes a dragon that they had seen and a hunting party that they sent out to try to kill it. They were unable to, but it also reports another that was seen and then killed a few miles away. That was called they described as a cockatrice again. This occurred in Essex, and the town in Henham, Essex, considers themselves best known for the dragon that was once seen there long ago. We have found cave paintings or stone carvings even in the Americas. This one was discovered in 1879 in Arizona, and it seems to be that of a large sauropod. In his book, After the Flood, Bill Cooper describes that as early as the 1900s, elderly folk in Wales would describe seeing pterosaur-like creatures when they were kids, and it's worth a read. An elderly inhabitant of Penland said that in his boyhood, the winged serpents were described as very beautiful. They were coiled when in repose and looked as if they were covered with jewels of all sorts. Some of them had crests sparkling with all the colors of the rainbow. When disturbed, they glide swiftly, sparkling all over to their hiding places. When angry, they flew over people's heads with outspread wings, bright and sometimes with eyes too, eyes glowing too, like the feathers in a peacock's tail. That's iridescence, though, not bioluminescence. Iridescence is the quality of a material that causes it to look different colors when you look at it, and that's how the colors in the peacock's tail are produced, through iridescence. He said it was no old story invented to frighten children, but a real fact. His father and uncle had killed some of them, for they were as bad as foxes for poultry. The old men attributed the extinction of the winged serpents to the fact that there were terrors in the farmlands and coverts. As I was doing research on this story, one theme kind of wove its way through all of the descriptions of dragons. And that was, people see dragon, people go kill dragon or try to kill dragon. And this is just a common theme. And you can come to your own conclusion about why people actively sought these out. You know, maybe you're from Louisiana or something. I don't know. You know, people from Louisiana, they eat all kinds of stuff. But, It's clear from the descriptions that people actively would hunt and kill these things. And I don't think it's that, it's a little obvious why that would be the case. But most of the descriptions would describe, you know, men just tend to naturally hunt things, right? You put a BB gun in a 12-year-old boy's hand and you should expect a number of dead birds in a very short period of time, right? Men just have this natural hunting instinct. And women have a tendency to, if anything that they're afraid of, they don't want it gone, they want it dead. You know, don't just put that outside, you kill that thing. You know what I mean? So a great many of these hunting parties were probably sent out by the women folk rather than for trophy hunting, you know. But men do a lot of trophy hunting as well, you know. If something has a threatening imposition, if something threatens us or our livelihood, we kill it. And so even if we thought they were threatening us or our livelihood, we kill it. And these creatures are about as threatening as an animal gets. A reptile gets larger than a small dog and gets within your house, and, you know, you're going to end up killing it, right? Well, probably so. There are a number of people that were sainted for killing dragons, and St. George is probably the best known, but there's actually a fairly extensive list. I assembled this one quickly. It's by no means complete. This just ranging through the 7th century of people that were made saints for killing dragons. And oddly, though, I found one of them was Martha, the sister of Lazarus from the Bible, who died and was buried in France, is known for being part in a party in an incident where a dragon was killed. She tamed it, went out and fed it food, and tamed it to the extent where she was able to guide it back in town. And when they got it back in town, the townspeople killed it. It's called a tarasque. And depictions of it, again, remind me of an ankylosaur, which, remember, were smaller, one of the smaller of the ornithischian dinosaurs. And the tarasque is still used in Corpus Christi processions on occasion. So you can still see the tarasque in some of these Corpus Christi processions. So, I puzzle as to why this would be the case. Why would people of faith be out there killing these dragons? But I think and these were these missionaries going out into pagan cultures. And around these dragons, you almost invariably would find idolatry and or superstition. And a person of faith would enter the area, seeing that the people were taken up by these creatures through superstition or idolatry, and they would do something about it. And it's a way of showing God's power. They weren't afraid of it. There was nothing superstitious. But there may be other motivations as well. You can find, like, this is an engraving that dates to the 1180s that shows a lion that's supposed to represent Christ killing a basilisk, which is supposed to represent the devil. And think of how serpents were described in the Bible, often as the embodiment of Satan. Think about the serpent in the Garden of Eden, right? They're also spoken of in such terms in the Revelation, where Michael, the archangel Michael, actually kills a dragon. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the dragon, the devil, or Satan. So, I don't know. Maybe there was some motivation there as well, that actually people of faith would kill them because they, in one way, saw them to be potentially the embodiment of Satan. That pagan cultures were worshiping them. You know, they saw this parallel in the Bible that they were, I don't know. It's at least an interesting proposal. But I think one, today, as I was researching this, you know, I find lots and lots of descriptions and depictions of dragons, these creatures, dinosaur-like creatures in human history. And you wonder, what happened to that? You know, what happened to all this history? To me, it seems very substantial, too substantial to be able to just sweep up under the rug. But it's like, and people have always believed in these things up until now. You know, within the last 150 or so years, 200 years at most, people have always believed in these things. But it was when the scientific community decided that the fossil record should be interpreted this way, in which these dinosaurs then went extinct 65 million years ago, suddenly all this history must be wrong. And we just are going to erase that and not pay any attention to that. But there are examples of other animals that that paleontologists thought went extinct that long ago also. And then lo and behold, they would find that they were still alive, like the coelacanth. The coelacanth, big fish, lobe-finned fish, they thought they went extinct at the time of the dinosaurs because they're not found in the upper layers of the fossil record either. But then lo and behold, fishermen pulled these things up off of the coast of Madagascar, you know, living deep in the Indian Ocean. Timothy said, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn away their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths." Maybe it's not the dragons that are the myths, right? But this interpretation of the fossil record that tells us these creatures went extinct 65 million years ago is in fact a myth, right? If you want to learn more about dragons, I wrote up articles on a number of these descriptions and linked on the Creation Wiki, a website that we started up. So you can go on the Creation Wiki, do a search for dragon, and read about some more of those. Let me close out in a prayer. Father, we thank you so much that you left us your word, Father. Without the word that you left us, we would truly be lost. Truly be lost. Father, we need your help. We need your wisdom. Father, open our minds to the truth. Help us to read your word and apply it to not only our everyday life, but the understanding of the world that we live in. Father, we love you. Father, we praise you. Father, we thank you for sending your son, Jesus. Praise you. In Christ's name, amen.